It's Philosophy Talk.
I'll try to speak in a jargon-free language.
Derrida and deconstruction.
Deconstruction is an ugly and difficult word.
What is it to deconstruct the text?
Deconstruction is to analyze all the hidden assumptions implied in the philosophical or the ethical or the political use of the concept of subjects.
If literary and philosophical texts are full of contradictions and devoid of absolute meaning or truth, why bother even reading them?
When you deconstruct anything, you do not destroy the legitimacy of what you're deconstructing.
Can we deconstruct deconstructionism?
Our guest is Joshua Cate, author of Fielding Derrida, Philosophy, Literary Criticism, History, and the Work of Deconstruction.
Deconstruction doesn't mean dissolution.
Derrida and deconstruction, coming up on Philosophy Talk.
After the news. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of KALW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus.
Today, Derrida and deconstruction.
Jacques Derrida was one of the most widely revered and also one of the most widely reviled thinkers of our time.
Yeah, people in a variety of disciplines, especially literary disciplines, view him as an absolutely seminal figure. He's been called one of the three most important philosophers of the 20th century. Right up there in this person's estimation with Heidegger and Wittgenstein, John.
But many philosophers would strongly disagree with that assessment, especially philosophers like you and me, Ken, who belong to the Anglo-American tradition.
Yeah, I'm afraid that in our circles, Derrida is widely regarded as something of a fraud and a charlatan, and people blame him for what they see as the really sorry state of literary studies.
But on this program, Ken, we question everything, even our own prejudices. So we should ask ourselves whether it's just those prejudices that keep us from appreciating Derrida.
Well, I certainly wouldn't say that it's just prejudice. I mean, for a guy who was deeply concerned about the nature of written language and the interpretation of written language, Derrida is awfully hard to read and interpret.
Harder than Kant or Hegel? Neither of those guys is easy to read or interpret, but nobody dismisses them as mere frauds and charlatans.
Well, maybe that's just the difference between German obscurity and French obscurity, John. I mean, German obscurity can seem, well, profound, but French obscurity is frankly just irritating.
Well, that's an insight, but there could be a deeper reason why Anglo-American philosophers often find Derrida so off-putting.
And what would that be?
Well, his work purports to undermine what we do, the foundation of our lives and our profession.
Well, I guess you're talking about what he calls the logocentrism of Western philosophy. We're all so logocentric, and Derrida claims to have moved us beyond it, beyond philosophy to post-philosophy.
Right. We anal-retentive, logo-phallocentric philosophers privileged logos, that is, meaning, reason, spirit. And we take speech to be prior in the order of signification to writing, and that's really bad.
Yeah, that's supposed to be really a consequential move, because somehow, by privileging speech over writing, logophallocentric philosophy privileges presence over absence and hankers after transcendental signifiers that transcend all signifiers and meanings that transcend all signs.
Well, I'm not sure what that means, but it sounds terrible.
Yeah, and it's all connected up to the metaphysics of presence, which is, some people tell me, supposed to be oppressive because it excludes, it marginalizes, fails to acknowledge what's absent, what's different, what's other. I mean, think in a concrete way of all the voices that the Western philosophical canon has typically excluded, the voices of women, blacks, gays, the poor, and on, by glorifying what's there. I take it the Western canon is fails to acknowledge what's not there, what's absent.
Well, that seems like a valid insight. I mean, you know, it is important to look at what's not there. But how, through the innocent act of taking the spoken word to be somehow prior to the written word, I mean, it must have come first, how do we do all that nasty stuff? That seems pretty astounding.
Well, it's a long story about how that works, John, but fortunately, you know, there's a way out. We execute a sort of reversal. We privilege text, that is, writing, over speech, because I take it the point is that, unlike speech, the text is constituted as much by what it excludes as by what it includes, by absence as much as presence. Because, look, if the text doesn't speak about women, blacks, or gays, for example, it thereby represents them. So its silence on something is a representation of what's not there. So a text can do that.
So, and I guess the way we get at absence via the text is by deconstructing it.
You mean like ripping it down, tearing it apart, sort of like tearing down a building?
Sort of, but not exactly. To deconstruct a text is to expose the contradictions and oppositions upon which it's founded, which it disguises and refuses to acknowledge, I suppose, make the absences somehow present. To deconstruct a text is to expose it as devoid of fixed meaning, as irreducibly complex, unstable, and even impossible.
Wow, John, that's a mouthful that you just said. I'm going to need some help getting my brain around all that.
Well, me too, actually. But help is on the way in the form of our guest, Joshua Cates, author of Fielding Derrida, Philosophy, Literary Criticism, History, and the Work of Deconstruction. Now, Ken, because we're on the radio, we're going to have to talk to him, even though that seems to be the source of all these problems.
Yeah, but we'll treat him as a text. We'll treat him as a text. And we want the help of our undeconstructed audience as well. But first, our roving philosophical reporter, Angela Kilduff, gets an earful of opinions about the controversial legacy of Derrida. She files this report.
Jacques Derrida is the father of deconstruction and a very divisive thinker. To find out whether he was a fraud or a revolutionary, I asked prominent academics about his significance.
My name is John Searle, and I teach philosophy at the University of California, Berkeley. Some authors are significant not because they solve philosophical confusions, but because they are examples of the confusion. And Derrida is interesting to us because he was hopelessly confused as a philosopher. Professional philosophers don't pay much attention to Derrida, but he has been influential in subjects like literary theory and comparative literature because he makes very pretentious claims of a quasi-philosophical sort, and he has no backing for the claims, but it does impress people who don't know anything about philosophy.
My name is Ellen Armour. I'm the E. Rhodes and Leona B. Carpenter Professor of Feminist Theology at Vanderbilt Divinity School. I think Derrida's legacy is obviously remains to be seen in some respects, but I hope that one legacy will be that he has helped us understand just how complicated and interconnected all kinds of issues are. I think part of the difficulty that surrounded Derrida's initial reception is that his work came in through literary theory and not through philosophy, and that shaped a certain kind of way of reading his work. A lot of that was really rich and productive, certainly in those early decades for literary scholars, but it also made him somewhat suspicious in the eyes of some philosophers and people who engage philosophy.
I really think that the lasting legacy is that he took the language of the history of philosophy into many fields, the field of human rights and other fields like that. I'm Peter Krupp, and I'm an associate professor of film and media studies, visual studies, English, informatics at UC Irvine. He has really, I think, made philosophy a big thing in fields as different as architecture and planning, art history, anthropology, film studies, literature, sociology, the history of science, and perhaps nowhere more than the history of technology in his thinking through the history of philosophy about communication, about misunderstandings, about interpretation, and about different technologies of communication.
My name is Ursula Heise. I'm a professor of English and director of the Modern Thought and Literature program at Stanford. The general legacy, I would say, mostly consists of a certain mode of inquiry, a particular analytical approach. So you approach a concept or a particular cultural or political configuration in terms of what it excludes or what it talks about, only to relegate it outside of itself and say, this is not us. And the Derridean move would consist of showing that this outside, this supplement, is in fact precisely the foundation of either the concept or of a particular cultural or political condition or configuration. And some people were very, very cutting about their critique of Derrida. They said, well, look, I mean, whatever is right in his philosophy has been said before, and then the rest is wrong and expressed obscurely.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Angela Kilduff.
I'm John Perry, and with me is Ken Taylor.
And our guest is Joshua Cates. He's a professor of English at Indiana University. He's author of Fielding Derrida, Philosophy, Literary Criticism, History, and the Work of Deconstruction. Joshua, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, Joshua, as we've just heard, Derrida's a tad controversial. How did a nice guy like you end up devoting a significant part of his career to the study of a thinker so difficult and controversial as Jacques Derrida?
That's a kind question. And an interesting one. I came across his work in the 70s when I was an undergraduate, and I attended one of those so-called great books colleges in Annapolis, St. John's. Mm. So I was very familiar with the Western tradition of texts and also texts in the history of math and science, and felt a loyalty to those. At the same time, I had grown up in New York City in the 60s, 70s, very tumultuous times, and had already had a deep interest in literature, modernist literature, and that sense that you get from T.S. Eliot onward, that the whole world has changed, that some kind of irreversible break with the past, the European past, has taken place. I felt that strongly as well, and Derrida and his thought was really a way to merge those two very different impulses that I found in myself.
So you were attracted by the idea of having your texts and deconstructing them too.
Yeah. Exactly.
So that term deconstruction has really made its way into common usage. I mean, Derrida invented a lot of words for expressing his ideas, but that's the one that's probably really made it. But what did Derrida mean by that term, and is that what people tend to mean by it who have adopted it?
Great question. No, in my experience, my undergraduates all use the word deconstruction to mean destroying something to a very great degree, right? Mm-hmm. To really taking it apart and apart and apart. And I emphasize for them a hyphenated on deconstruction means to build something new by taking apart something else. And one of the things that I think distances Derrida's work from the significant kind of philosophy that you and Ken practice is that he was searching for a different kind of conceptuality. And he believed that one way into that was by taking apart the concepts that had been handed down. But he also believed there was no other way to get to his thoughts except through that process, and only out of the old did the new emerge.
Well, let's try a simple example for our listeners, not to mention me. Give us a text, say the Declaration of Independence or Plato's Republic or Rousseau, whatever you want. Give us a text and illustrate this idea of finding the absences in it and deconstructing it, seeing its true significance in terms of those absences.
See if you can do that in 1 minute.
Yes.
In one another.
If, not, we'll continue it later.
No, that's great. I mean, you know, the classic one, and it came up in your opening piece, which I enjoyed very much, by the way, was his discussion of the Phaedrus of Plato and the claim that you find repeatedly in Plato that speech came before writing, that there was spoken language before written language. And by the way, Derrida did not doubt that that might be factually accurate, but his question was, how could there be written language? Did it change the essence of language when it appeared? And if not, then by privileging the example of the spoken, weren't you taking a narrow teleological view of language as a whole? So the ability of language to function in the absence of its user was intrinsic to what it was, and that the way the problem had been approached from the first within the tradition had limited the set of possibilities of thinking about language, what language was and what it could do.
So, Josh, you kind of jumped ahead because you're going to help us deconstruct an idea or a text, and you told us about the priority of speech over. Well, so we'll come back and try and gather our thoughts a little bit more after break. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about deconstruction and Derrida with Joshua Cates from Indiana University.
Have you ever deconstructed a piece of writing? What did you discover by deconstructing it? by finding the absences in the midst of the presences. Some people think that deconstruction undercuts and diminishes the value of reading, especially reading the Western canon, all those works that we want on our shelves and occasionally want our children to read. What do you think? Is the great canon of Western civilization still worth our time, or should we move beyond it?
Deconstructing the Western canon, when Philosophy Talk continues.
Spare your heart, everything put together. Sooner or later falls apart, and there's nothing to it, nothing to it. You can cry.
Paul Simon receding from presence into absence. The Western canon was put together by privileging the voices of the powerful. Does everything fall apart when we deconstruct it? I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor, and this is Philosophy Talk. What can we learn by deconstructing a text? Or do you prefer your text undeconstructed? And should we move beyond the canon of Western civilization once it has been thoroughly deconstructed?
Our guest is Joshua Cates from Indiana University, author of Fielding Derrida.
So, Josh, I want to get us more deeply into just what deconstruction means, but I want to take off where you were just before the break. Help me understand, why is it even an important issue for Derrida, whether speech or writing is prior? I mean, why would anybody care about that issue?
Sure, that's a totally reasonable question. And the standard versions of language, if you go back to even Aristotle, assume that different words of different conventional languages differ, but the thoughts that they express and the things that they speak about are the same for everyone. And in most modern philosophy of language, this has been attacked as a kind of idealist view of language, a view of unchanging meaning and unchanging parts of speech. And Derrida saw that distinction as a crucial way into attacking those problems in the context that he worked, which was a context set up largely by Husserl, Hegel, and Kant, and not the Russell Frege nexus with which you guys operate daily.
Well, let me give you an analogy, though. I mean, I think there's a lot in what Derrida says about the importance between spoken and written language, and that written language is an example of technology. But compare hitting someone and throwing a rock at them. Throwing a rock at them is technology. It enables us to injure someone who is absent, not thousands of miles away, but somewhat absent. That has led to more and more technology until we can actually destroy civilizations on the other side of the world. And it makes a difference. When you're fighting someone face to face, you see what happens to them. You're in a relation to them. You see their pain and suffering. Once you can learn to throw a rock at someone or shoot a gun at someone or drop a nuclear bomb on someone, it really changes things. All of that seems to me really important, and it goes over to language. A text that you leave can influence people after you're dead. A letter that you write can influence people far away, and you won't see what that influence is, and it may not be what you expect. All of that makes perfectly good sense to me. But why do we have to get into transcending the transcended, transcending, transcendental gobbledygook to make those simple and profound points?
Yeah.
Sure, but the very difference you're talking about, I mean, again, Derrida worked out of a different tradition, particularly the Husserlian. We can leave that discussion to a different day. But the main point, John, where you just say there's a difference between hitting somebody and throwing something at a distance, but it's that whole schema that Derrida's questioning, as if there was an innocent moment of contact and presence, and then a fall, which technology and absence introduced. Derrida wanted to say, no, that possibility was there from the start, and he wanted to think to arrive at concepts that thought the origin differently.
Wait a minute. Slow down. You're getting complicated here. So the first form of communication.
Nothing profound.
First form of communication, okay. Face-to-face communication, right? Communication as a kind of action, interacting. Okay, later forms of communication allows communication at a distance. And look, even when we're communicating face-to-face, we can communicate about things that are not there. I can tell you about the rock that I saw that you're not seeing, but the communication is face-to-face. It can refer to all kinds of things that are not present. Okay, and then writing, and there's this innovation of writing. Or pictures on cave walls or something, which can communicate, which I can inscribe them, and somebody else can later interpret them. Okay, I do think there is a big deal about this, and maybe this is what Derrida has. Because when we're communicating face to face, if you're puzzled, I can tell you what I mean. I can tell you what I intend, and you aren't really in a position to say, well, that's not what you intend. I mean, I say, I intend to refer to John. You say, no, you don't intend to refer to John. But with a written text, when I'm not present, well, trying to figure out what I mean is difficult. I grant that. And but Derrida and people who follow him seem to say, think that in the written text, the originator's intentions drops out from any special role. Is that right?
Well, yes, we can... talk about the originator's intention, and it actually full circles back to where you began, Ken, because, in other words, just as I said to John, the whole schema of later earlier is what Derrida's question. That first you said, yes, we can talk to one another, we're face to face, we refer to things that are absent. But as we all know, we also speak to one another in a language that we have not given ourselves. So in a sense, there's already the distance of language even in that face to face communication.
Well, now, that's a good point. I mean, we employ words that other people, I don't know if they invented them, but came to use them and invested with meanings, and we can continue to use them even though those meanings are absent. I mean, I talk about arthritis. I'm not sure what it is. Tyler Burge pointed that out. On the radio, you hear all kinds of things about republicanism, and they don't know what the term means. There's emotional values that attach to terms that remain with them long after Glenn Beck has started using them in ways that have nothing to do with what they mean. Those are great ideas.
Those are great ideas, and those are common ideas to all kinds of people. Those ideas really have nothing in particular to do. They're not the particular heritage of deconstructionism, although one of the things that drives philosophers crazy about literary people is they actually don't know how widespread some of these ideas in philosophy, and mostly what they think about philosophy is a caricature of philosophy. And we have a caller on the line. Henry from San Francisco is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Henry.
Thank you. I'm calling to question your intelligence because Derrida's obituary included a statement that he was giving BS a bad name, meaning America's pastime is and its preoccupation is to build up, deconstruct, whilst reinforcing dogma, social fairy tales in place of the truth.
Henry, I don't know what all that's supposed to mean. What is that? What's the point of that speech act you just performed?
What's the point of that speech? Well, you know, the point of that speech is I'm a disciple of the self-entertainment movement.
The self-entertainment movement.
And so I think that Derrida was in the self-entertainment business, and I think he might have given BS a bad name, but he's not alone in that. And I think philosophy is passed off for whatever. Body of work somebody wants to get out there who's willing to listen.
Okay, Henry,
that's a cynical point of view. You know, Kant said that carnal self-defilement is worse than murder. So I hope by self-entertainment you have a somewhat broader thing in mind.
Okay, well, Henry, thanks for the call. But Josh, I'm not quite sure.
I just wanted to jump in both to your previous point, Ken, and even this. I mean, because I've tried as best I could to be responsible to both the kind of philosophy you guys do, to the technical side of it. And I agree, a lot of people don't take the time to do that. But at the same time, the other side of the coin is that Derrida was trained in a specific tradition of philosophy, which was a different tradition, and it had its own demands, and you need, my claim in my work has often been, you need to know that vocabulary in the way he did. This fellow with the self-entertainment, the entire cultural sphere, and this is a reason why Derrida was more important to literary critics or cultural critics, is that that you could say, I mean, Derrida was more, his goal as a thinker was more like a Hegel than a Russell. He was more interested in getting a comprehensive picture of a problem. So he really didn't value writing over speech. He was looking for the thing that they both had in common that difference had left out. But he wasn't a problem solver. He didn't have the way I respect that work, by the way, but the way other kinds of philosophers sit down, they have a question, they're going to solve it in a finite time. That was not his style.
Okay.
It was more a comprehensive thinking, and that's why literary critics call, and about things like technology, the genetic code, how our world may be undergoing a very radical shift of a kind that none of us actually have a total handle on.
Well, Joshua, I mean, you know, I like reading Russell and Frege. I can read Husserl with great benefit, and I do so fairly often. Sartre, I love reading Sartre. Heidegger's a stretch, but there's a lot of good insights there. Derrida is like another level of beyond. And I must say, your book is one of the best things in the literature that for understanding it for us as more pedestrian thinkers.
He's just saying that because you mentioned him in your book. But let me ask an actual question and refocus this conversation.
Sure, please.
I want to understand the reading technique that deconstructing a text is, right? I have heard people say all kinds of different things. My colleague Josh Landy, who's a literary theorist type person, thinks deconstruction is just driven us away from the text. It's not a reading of the text. It's imposing all this other stuff. But tell us what actually deconstructing a text, what kind of reading technique that is.
It's a perfect question. And unfortunately, too often, it has been taken to be a license for saying anything. But as Derrida fashioned it, it was a very careful attention to the text, and he claimed to do two kinds of things. I mean, he wanted to present a reading that was in contact with, that was a, you know, what sometimes called a first level interpretation, that was responsible to the way the text had been received and understood, but then also open up new avenues within it. But because of the way he did that, I mean, you could say, well, isn't that just a new reading of the text? And the deconstructed, I mean, take Husserl. He made a claim about that Husserl was, on the one hand, his view of language and how it operated was, on the one hand, had some constitutive contradictions, problems it couldn't resolve. On the other hand, he claimed those problems were part of everyone's view of language. It wasn't like you could do what Husserl was doing and get a better version of it. You had to break entirely with the project.
I want to break you away from Husserl. John, you're going to put a question to Josh.
Well, yeah, I want our audience, it'd be nice if they were able to grasp everything going on with Derrida, but they're not going to. But I think there's some real practical ideas he had that are good, that philosophers should understand that's part of it. Now, I'm going to give you a text, and I want you to deconstruct it in your style, not Derrida's. So here's the first line of the Gettysburg Address. 67 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Now tell me, and this will be a transition to our next segment, on political philosophy, what's present, what's absent, and what's the difference between when Lincoln said it and when we read it now as a written text?
Great questions. Let me take the last of them, because you know that part of what's different now is that this has entered our political discourse as a kind of shibboleth, that you cannot question what, you know, whether or in what way we really believed all men were created equal, when the nation was founded, the conditions under which it was founded, whether it was out of an idealist or other that kind of goal or other reasons it was founded, and that if one were to, that the use of history already by Lincoln was a kind of memorializing use that was to legitimate the present politics of his time. And now that's become even more of an issue where you could not, right, if we taught this to children and asked them to think about it, to argue with it, we would be, you know, some of us would not be allowed to teach.
Let me try something on you as a summing up of what you just said. I think maybe I've got it wrong. So Lincoln, when he uttered this text, when he produced this text, was performing a certain kind of act, locating himself relative to certain other people in certain time, construing his political horizons in a certain way. All that doing is not worn on the sleeves of the text, right? But we, by reading, deconstructing the text, can get at what he was doing. And that's not something that we do in consuming that text. That's something that he was doing. We do something else. So its significance for us is one thing. The significance of his doing is in producing this text is another thing. And deconstruction somehow helps us to be clear about all that. Is that the right way to think about it?
Well, let me just say, I think the most striking thing about the first line of the Gettysburg Address is it's false. Right? I mean, our fathers didn't bring forth on the continent a new nation conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. They used those words, but they were dedicated to the proposition
that
men were created equal.
That's what I mean.
We could put off worrying about the others.
By uttering these texts with these words, with this kind of surface meaning, mm-hmm. he's actually legitimizing a certain kind of oppressive order and blah, 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 a kind of mythical thing to it, and that's not worn on the sleeves of the meaning. It's an example of persuasive definition.
But let me just jump in and say, but Derrida, and you know, the one he did do is the opening passage of the Constitution. I mean, Derrida always had a double-sided relation to his text. So what you're saying, Ken, I mean, it includes that, but that would be more like a historicizing or, okay, all of this is left out. And I think Derrida thought it was important. But he also thought in some of these texts like, I'm trying to remember the beginning of the Constitution, but where they bring themselves into being, how do you found a nation? Is there something about a text that's necessary? Are there a people before when we say we the people hold these truths to be self-evident? Was there a people prior to that moment of announcing itself? How does a political community found itself? He thought those questions needed to be addressed through the play of difference and presence that what he called text thematized.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing the philosophy of Jacques Derrida with Joshua Cates from Indiana University.
Deconstruction isn't just a style of literary analysis. It also has a political dimension. The act of deconstructing a text by helping expose what's not there can, it is thought, help us along the path towards liberation.
Deconstruction and political liberation, when Philosophy Talk continues.
We're picking up the pieces of the results of Jacques Derrida's deconstruction. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Joshua Cates from Indiana University.
Josh, lots of people associate Derrida and deconstruction with identity politics, the so-called politics of difference. Is there any truth to that?
It's very limited truth. Derrida did not endorse identity politics. He actually was often criticized from a certain far left from the 60s onward. At the same time, he certainly opened the door, particularly at first in feminist theory and other places, to questioning about the other, about what is you have mentioned what was left out, but his whole thinking did not valorize identity. It was more interested in both difference and looking for making difference comprehensive.
Well, that's interesting. A lot of people casually do think, I guess they just think of Derrida is somehow a postmodern kind of guy, and postmodernism as associated with identity politics, the politics of difference and all that. And so, you know, kind of relativism, you know, I think we have a caller on the line who wants to ask a question along this line. Kevin and Anselmo, welcome to Philosophy Talk, Kevin.
Yes, I was in Europe this past summer with a professor of religious studies from Wabash College, and he thought that the legacy of postmodernism had sort of left not only American culture but Western civilization in a rudderless relativism without the sustaining and uplifting benefit of a meta-narrative. What's your feeling about that?
And does Derrida have any role? Thanks for the question, Kevin. Does Derrida have any role in bringing about that state of affairs? Because lots of people think he does.
Yes, you're right. A lot of people do. I would say two things. In these more narrow circles, we distinguish postmodernism from post-structuralism. Put Derrida in the latter category. More to the point is that if you think that a French thinker, no matter how widely read, could contribute to an entire cultural relativism, you put a very high weight on intellectual production. The other way of looking at it is that people like Derrida, in his own way, Foucault, Lyotard, saw a kind of corrosive nihilism already infecting the culture and asked, was there a way of thinking that could take that into account but keep alive some of the traditions of the Enlightenment in ancient Greece? But they also felt those traditions had to be transformed if they were going to be effective in the world that was a borning that was so much different from where they started out.
So let's probe this. I mean, this is fascinating stuff. And I don't really know what I think about any of this. So I'm asking this in a completely open-minded kind of way. So look, one of the things that some people think about deconstruction as a kind of style of literary analysis is one of the reasons that it's so attractive to so many people is that it opens up room to think about what's been absent. And that's the marginalized voices and how those texts kind of construe the marginalized voices in a way that has to be exposed, right? And once you expose these texts and their role in construing the absent, then the question is there any use for those texts anymore? I mean, doesn't that now make the Western canon, once deconstructed, no longer worth our time? Right. No longer. I mean, you got to do this moment of deconstructing it. But once you deconstruct it and see what it's done, don't you want to move beyond it? Don't you want to relegate it to, you know, the trash pile of, you know, oppressive history?
Yes. I hear you. Again, that is not how I don't, you know, you might say ironically, I don't think those were Derrida's intentions and those were not his texts. I love and respect Plato. And I always read him, and he did. I would say this to you, that Derrida and people like him, as I read them, were trying to allow for those considerations. Why, for example, and he was, you know, very fascinating on Hegel, the family, the orphan. Why is the orphan excluded? Why do women have a certain role? But to bring them together with the leading philosophical themes and to weave, right, that so you had to keep reading the text because the stakes of the questions of this other didn't exist apart from these larger questions. It continued the tradition in that way. It was as much a recovery act as it was a jettisoning. It did both, and it said, yes, we have to, why did Kant have certain views on who was a human being and who not? But if you thought that was all of Kant, you'd also be missing the point. And what I said earlier about the word deconstruction, that to think a new thought, you have to take apart an old one, but part of it is to keep those questions that Kant raised, which had to do, among other things, about transcendental conditions.
I just want to interject here that Ken's question reminded me of a novel that I want to draw to the attention of our readers, and that's David Lodge's Small World. Because one of the key events in there is when an English professor is trying to explain, he's trying to write a paper that explains exactly what Ken asked. Why, once you've deconstructed everything and decided that laundry lists and the Declaration of Independence as, you know, are really not that different, why should English professors continue teaching the canon? We have quite a bit of email, and one of our emails is from a English professor who's preparing a syllabus on Derrida and other things and wonders if the whole idea of preparing a syllabus isn't somehow contrary to the content of the syllabus. So anyway, there's a lot of interesting questions, and I think this novel, I don't know if Joshua agrees, really poses some of them quite nicely.
Certainly, Joshua, you have to agree that the text Look, you went to St. John's. I was a great bookie at Notre Dame. My major was a program of liberal studies, and I was imbued in this great book traditions. And they tend to have a very reverential attitude toward the canon as a repository of kind of developing truths, an ongoing discourse and dialogue that unfolds developing truths. And, you know, it gets refined and all that sort of stuff, but they don't try to see through it. They don't try to expose it. Isn't deconstruction about kind of exposing the text as less than what as more and less than what it purports to be? And once you expose it's exposed.
No, I hear you, but I think many people have taken it that way, and we can talk about the state of literary studies. But that, as Derrida practiced it, who was trained in a very rigorous setting in, you know, early 50s France, it was devoted to the exegesis of the text. He wanted it, and part of, if you read, for example, Derrida's on Hegel, and is one of the most insightful commentators, or he brought Levinas to the attention of the world because by the way, on issues of relativism, he attacked Foucault in 1962, and Foucault didn't talk to him for 10 years, and by the way, Searle is siding in that little family quarrel. But the point is that Derrida was a serious reader from start to finish, and he wanted to blend those concerns.
Let's move away from Derrida to, let's call it, the deconstructionism, as it were. So Derrida, not as a presence, but as part of this whole thing, right? Because we can't privilege Derrida and his intentions, because it's the text that he gave. You know, the text, the performances that he gave rise to.
You're drinking the lemonade, Ken.
No. I'm just saying, I don't think one can deny. And I actually think, if not Derrida, then deconstructionism undermines the importance of, raises this question, why bother with this canon?
Why don't we just call it radical linguistic relativism? Certainly does that. Any whether it was Derrida, anybody that says there's no meanings, no, you know, nothing, will do that. But again, are you kind of an idealist in the history of thought? Do you really think that it was that belief that led people to be sloppy readers, or was there not a change, you know, in the conditions?
I disagree with Derrida about something very fundamental. I do think the text has a meaning that's not unstable. I don't, all that stuff, the text is impossible, unstable, that's just gibberish. I don't know why anybody would believe that. That part of it is just gibberish. And that's an excuse for putting on interpretations of the text that serve one's own in political aims or one's interpretative aims, and it makes it completely undisciplined.
We're agreeing about that. I'm saying that with anybody who believes you can't read better or worse, that you can't have a rational argument about what a text says, is going to be in a strange business as an interpreter. But I don't think Derrida believed that, and I don't think that's what's happened to the humanities, in my view. It speaks to far greater differences in the shift that we think and live and work. And you guys are fighting the good fight but I want you to know there's some people out there in literary studies, some even Derridians, who also are fighting and trying to keep alive a certain respect for thought and for reading. But as I say, this was a sense that to do that, you might have to also question. You have to do both. And that was sort of his lesson, or the legacy I took for him.
So look, let's say one last thing here, and then we're going to have to say goodbye.
Yes,
I actually think there are laudable impulses in Derrida about how to take a text and how to contextualize it and how to see that, you know, it's about much as what it explicitly says is what it leaves out. I mean, you got to do that. That's a laudable impulse. But I do believe that taking this stuff too far has led to the ruin of the literary humanities. And one of the things I want to see is philosophy in the humanities. Derrida calls himself a post-philosopher, or deconstructionist talking about post-philosophy. We need to return to philosophy, not get beyond it. And one of the things that would be really good if all these literary folks actually read the main works of analytic philosophy of the 20th and 21st century and incorporated that in there.
You really want those guys deconstructing?
I don't want them deconstructing it. I want them learning from it. But Josh, I'm going to give you a chance to respond to whatever you want, and then we're going to have to say goodbye.
No, well, thank you. No, I myself have tried modestly to read the major works of 20th and 21st century analytic philosophy, have learned a lot from them. But at the same time, I do think there are the two gulfs. There are different traditions, as you know, of philosophy, and there's ways that think that philosophy has to be more textual, Hegel, Heidegger. But A and B, the other side is that whether, you know, analytic philosophy is a form of research. Whether we need a different kind of discourse to go forward is an open question.
On that note, I'm going to thank you for joining us. It's actually been a constructive conversation.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I really enjoyed it and appreciate the opportunity to speaking with both of you. Thank you very much.
Our guest has been Joshua Cates. He's professor of English at Indiana University, author of Fielding Derrida, Philosophy, Literary Criticism, History, and the Work of Deconstruction. John, we don't have much time for a last thought, but you got a last thought?
Well, we had a lot of good email. We weren't able to get to most of it, but one of our favorite correspondents, Gregory Slater, offered a definition of deconstruction, identifying the unspoken assumptions on which a text is based. If that's what it is, I'm all for it. But whenever I see the word transcends, whether it's written by a literary critic or a philosopher, I just turn off.
This conversation continues on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is cogito ergo blogo. I think, therefore I blog. And you can find out more about our program by visiting our very active Facebook page.
And you can sign up to get the free, that is free, no charge whatsoever, free weekly podcast of Philosophy Talk at our website, philosophytalk.org. For the final word, we turn to the high-speed logocentrism of Ian Scholes, the 60-second deconstructor.
Ian Scholes, I recently watched the documentary Derrida, and I wasn't bored exactly, but I was more entertained reading the various comments about the movie at IMDb, Amazon, and Netflix. Most people hated the movie with an inexplicable passion. Those few who liked it suggested that viewers need to watch it with a deconstructive eye, that it is a documentary that exposes its own documentariness. Derrida gets a haircut. Derrida butters a muffin. And it's true. If you think of the filmmakers as stalkers, the movie suddenly achieves resonance. You keep waiting for Derrida to issue a restraining order. Perhaps it would have been better if we'd seen Derrida actually doing something, ending racism, say, or engaging in a duel with a critic. If the filmmakers had thrown a zombie or two into the mix, which is all the rage these days, or showed Derrida driving a wooden stake into the shriveled heart of a logocentric vampire, by golly, we might have had something. It occurs to me that philosophers may not be the best subjects for movies. And yet, sometimes they are. Cartesius was an Italian movie directed by Roberto Rossellini about René Descartes. It was one of three television specials he directed, the others being about Socrates and Pascal. Previously, he had made a biopic called Augustine of Hippo. The DVD of that is available at the Vatican Bookstore. Socrates also makes an appearance in Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, and James Mason played him in a British movie from 1982. Near as I can tell, nobody has seen that movie. British filmmaker Derek Jarman was commissioned by Channel 4 to make a movie about Wittgenstein. I gather that a central point of the movie is that Wittgenstein's great thinking came about because of his repressed guilt about being gay. Doubt it. There's When Nietzsche Wept, based on a novel by Irv Yalom about a fictional encounter between Nietzsche and a psychoanalyst. Armand Assante plays Nietzsche. John Huston made Freud back in 1962 with Montgomery Clift. Philosophy Connection, well, the original screenplay was by Jean-Paul Sartre. But he and Huston did not get along. Also not available on DVD. Director Liliana Cavani, who made the rather appalling movie Night Porter, also gave us Beyond Good and Evil in 1974, with Ingmar Bergman actor Erland Josephson as Nietzsche. Christopher Plummer played Aristotle in Alexander with Colin Farrell. This movie contains the memorable line, "Come, Macedonians, ride, ride," though Aristotle does not say it. He also does not say, "Come, Bucephalus, today we ride to our destiny." These lines are left to poor Colin Farrell. The Last Days of Immanuel Kant, based on an essay by Thomas De Quincey, is a fresh movie that can't be played on American DVD players. That's about it, near as I can tell. Philosophers and movies, rare. And not available in your area. Except for Alexander, of course, which is begging you to watch it. Come, Bucephalus, today we ride to our destiny. I gotta go.
The Wisdom of the Ages, in a nutshell, from Ian Scholes, the 60-Second Philosopher.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Minella Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University. Copyright 2011.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
Our production coordinator is Devin Strolovich. Our directors of research are Daniel Elstein and Ben Hirsch. Leo Weiss is our webmaster.
Also thanks to Chris Hoff, Merle Kessler, Corey Goldman, and Mark Stone.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and the Friends of Philosophy Talk.
And the members of KALW San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed and the ones misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.